Good afternoon. We have our third case today, 2012-AP-393-CR, State v. Tolliver. Arguing on behalf of the defendant Tolliver is James Eric Goldschmidt. Mr. Goldschmidt, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is James Goldschmidt with Quarles & Brady, and I represent defendant Cortez Lorenzo Tolliver. The statute that brings us all together today is section 970.032 of the Wisconsin statutes, titled Preliminary Examination, Juvenile Under Original Adult Court Jurisdiction. That statute requires that before a juvenile can be tried directly as an adult, without the benefit of a waiver hearing, the circuit court must first do one thing. The court shall first determine whether there is probable cause to believe that the juvenile has committed the violation of which he or she is accused. If the court does not make that finding, the court shall order that the juvenile be discharged. This appeal can be...
Shall order the juvenile to what?
The court shall order that the juvenile be discharged.
Okay.
This appeal can be reduced to two questions, and both are questions of statutory interpretation. The first question is, did the circuit court fail to make the specific probable cause finding required by section 970.032? The second question is whether the court's failure to make that finding caused it to lose subject matter jurisdiction. The answer to both of those questions is yes. The court failed to do what it was required to do in order to retain jurisdiction in this matter.
Counselor, you read the statement in sub 1 as if the circuit court doesn't state with specificity which particular crime that draws the juvenile under the adult procedures for a criminal case, then the circuit court has not fulfilled its obligation under the statute, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there any legislative history or anything to indicate that that's how you view the statute?
We're interpreting the plain language of the statute, Your Honor.
Well, the court doesn't have original jurisdiction unless it has it under 938.183, so it first gets there by the fact that 938.183 provides the court with original jurisdiction, and you only get that, in this instance, through 1 a.m., right?
That's correct.
And so we wouldn't be under 970.032 without the court first having original jurisdiction for this particular charge.
Correct. And what we would say is that the court is, that jurisdiction is conferred upon the court in the first instance in exactly the way that you've described, Justice Sigler, and then it has that jurisdiction for so long as it makes that probable cause determination. If it makes the probable cause determination, the jurisdiction persists and the case continues to trial or a plea, as in this case. If it does not make that determination, that jurisdiction is lost.
Do you think the court can make a probable cause determination for a different crime under this scenario?
I think the court made the probable cause determination that it said it made, which is that a felony has been committed. We don't know which felony because the court didn't say. And that's what the court is required to do under this statute.
But, Counselor, there was only one felony that would be qualifying that was in the complaint, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
And there was no evidence presented at the hearing of any other felony, correct?
That's correct.
So if he's going to find a felony, the court's going to find a felony, it has to be the felony that was pleaded. Why isn't that appropriate to fulfill the statutory obligation?
I'm not sure it's correct that the court has to find the felony that was pleaded. If you think of an adult...
Well, I'm not saying the court has to, but in this particular case, what was pleaded was a qualifying felony, correct?
That's correct.
All right. So that's what was pleaded. And then you have a hearing to see if there's probable cause for a bindover of what is currently in the complaint, right?
Well, I think it's a bit more nuanced than that.
Okay.
If you consider an adult, routine adult bindover.
No, I'm just going to consider a juvenile one.
The facts described at the hearing itself
yes.
could describe any one of several offenses, some of which were qualifying, some of which were not. And we have no indication of whether the court was conducting the analysis.
But you only conduct a bindover when you have a felony in a complaint to determine whether you proceed further, correct? If you had a misdemeanor, you aren't going to have a preliminary hearing, right?
As a procedural matter, I think that's correct.
Okay.
But the point that I'm trying to make is that at this particular hearing,
right.
which had one purpose, which was to determine whether to try this juvenile as an adult,
right.
the court made no reference to the charges in the complaint. They appear nowhere in the transcript.
I know, but we always look at the totality of the circumstances that are going on. I mean, these decisions are not made in a vacuum. And I can understand why just relying on the words of the statute give you comfort, but it doesn't give me a lot of comfort because I have to look at everything that's going on at the time, and I'm looking at the complaint. If he had presented other evidence at the hearing of some kind of a lesser included charge that wouldn't have been a qualifier, and I haven't studied this particular complaint to give you any examples, but just say that he had, then I think you maybe have a different question of what felony the court found over. But when you have only one, and there's no evidence offered to show that even one that wasn't pled was what should have been charged, then I'm not sure how you get beyond comparing the complaint to the obligations of the court at the hearing. And that's what I'm having trouble with.
I think maybe the problem is that your question assumes that the court knew that this was a proceeding for the purpose of trying a juvenile as an adult. And I don't think that if you're looking at the totality of the circumstances, I don't think there's anything there that affirms that assumption.
You don't think the court recognized a 16-year-old boy standing in front of him?
Not necessarily, and we can't know that because we weren't there. The only way that we can know is because the court has to make that specific finding that it didn't make here. The fact is, actually, we're sitting here guessing about what happened. Yes, Your Honor.
Do you make anything of the last sentence in sub 1 that says if the court does not make that finding, then the court shall order the juvenile to be discharged? And the court was required to order the juvenile discharged if the probable cause finding for adult jurisdiction was not made in the court. Kept the juvenile in adult court. That kind of works both ways. I get how your argument works, but do you acknowledge that it works against you, too?
That is an argument that the state has made in its brief, which is that we can infer backwards from the fact that the court held on to the juvenile after the fact. But I don't think that's what the statute calls the court to do.
Well, it does not say if the court does. I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I'm just trying to figure it out.
No, maybe the better way to put it would be that question, too, assumes that the court knew that it was acting under this statute and that it had that requirement, that it had that burden imposed upon it at the
was
time.
Was this statute cited in the transcript?
Nowhere, Your Honor.
Was there any indication that the court was dealing with a juvenile matter? Now, the complaint must have given the date of birth, didn't it?
So, yes.
If the judge had looked at the complaint, it would have been noticeable that the person was 16. It's hard to tell sometimes whether a person is 16 or 18 by just looking at them. I just went to a juvenile court matter last night, and I would have sworn the person who was there was 20. I think he was 15. So nothing about this proceeding that says anything about a juvenile.
No.
Nothing,
right.
No citation to the statutes here.
No.
Not at all.
Not
by the trial court.
No.
Not by the defendant.
No.
Not by the state's counsel.
No.
looks like a regular bindover.
Looks exactly like a regular bindover.
And it could have been a lesser offense, whether included or not, on an issue of intent.
For example, yes.
For example. And if it had been a regular criminal trial, judge would have just found a felony.
Correct. And I think the implication of that is we can make all of these inferences and guesswork that, various members of the court are suggesting, but the fact that we have to do that in the first instance means that the court, the circuit court, didn't do what it should have done here. The fact that this...
Mr. Goldschmidt, let me interrupt you for just a minute. I understand that Judge Faye Flancher also reviewed this matter. And it's my understanding that when she reviewed the transcript, she was convinced that indeed Judge Constantine made the correct findings. She looked at the totality of the transcript. She looked at the complaint and all of the information that had been presented. What big mistake did she make? She said, the findings that were required by the statute were made. May not have been made explicitly, but they were made when you looked at the whole transcript. How was she wrong?
I think there are two mistakes there. One is that I think it's impossible as a procedural matter for Judge Flancher to have done what she did. The statute itself says if the circuit court does not make that finding, it shall order that the juvenile be discharged. That's it. So you don't get a second bite at the apple. Even setting that point aside, as a substantive matter, if you look at the 10 pages of the transcript, I don't see anything in there that would have allowed that judge to make the determination that she did. So I would question that determination on the merits because, as we've just discussed, there truly is nothing in there to distinguish that hearing from a routine adult bindover.
Well, she said, hey, it's implicit. When he said he was binding it over, it's implicit. There's no dispute. He heard the testimony from the victim. And Judge Constantine found probable cause that a felony was committed. While he didn't specifically say there's probable cause to believe that he committed count one or count two, the court did note that the testimony was shot, defendant was shot with a firearm, paralyzed. And you have the ID, you have the shooting, bindover's ordered. So clearly from this transcript, the court did indeed find probable cause that Tolliver, that there was probable cause to support the two counts by a person under the age. I mean, she's saying, what else could he have found?
She's suggesting an inference.
That's right.
And we're not here to say that this statute permits no inferences whatsoever. Certainly in a close case, if the finding itself is ambiguous, you could look to other indicators on the transcript of the preliminary hearing to see, for example, whether the judge had mentioned that this defendant was a juvenile or had mentioned that it was making this specialized determination under this particular statute as opposed to a routine adult bindover.
You keep denying in your brief, if I read it right, that you don't have to have magic words.
That's right? Correct.
On the other hand, it really sounds as if you do have to have magic words. You have to have the magic word that I find him guilty of the charge. That would be good, right?
That would be good.
Yeah. You could find the magic words of repeating the statute. I mean, that's not a big deal to ask of a judge. Repeat the statute, right?
That's true.
All right. Suppose you say, and I find him guilty of the following elements, bloom, 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 and those are the elements of the charge. Would that be good enough?
I think all of these different ways that you've just described, Your Honor, would either be good enough or come close to what the court ought to do, but at a minimum, the court's finding should contain a specific finding of probable cause as to a qualifying offense. And that didn't happen here. Maybe one way to think of it is, if we have one statute that says we find this generic probable cause for adult defendants, and we have another statute that calls for something more when we have a juvenile defendant, then if you can't tell the difference between an adult finding and this finding, something logically is wrong.
Why is he harmed? I mean, he gets a fair trial. So the judge didn't do it right. He gets a fair trial. It's harmless error.
I think this statute has to be understood within the context of the Juvenile Justice Code more generally, which is permeated by the legislature's recognition that children and adults are very, very different in very important ways. We process them differently. We penalize them differently. These distinctions aren't slight. They're worlds apart, and they're very carefully crafted. And this particular statute is the only thing that stands between a juvenile and the world of adults. So in other scenarios where the crime charged is less severe, that juvenile can have a waiver hearing before being sent off to adult court, but not here. Here the crime charged is serious, and for these particular crimes, the only thing, the one thing, standing between this defendant and the adult criminal justice system, which is not designed for him, by the way, and which is very serious and which locked this defendant up for 27 years, is this specific probable cause finding.
Counselor, the facts that were shown at the hearing show there was an attempted homicide, correct?
They could support that finding, yes.
Okay. And there was no other evidence presented that would support a different crime, correct?
The same evidence presented at the hearing would support multiple different crimes. Some of them would be homicide crimes, some would not. Some would be qualifying offenses, some would not.
You can shoot someone in the back with a gun as they run away, and that's going to be a non-qualifying offense. What would that be?
Any of several that we've listed in our brief.
Uh-huh. Like what?
Reckless endangerment comes to mind. There are several others at, I believe, footnote 6 and page 31 of our brief that we've listed, which would also meet those elements.
Thank you.
Can we get into the question of waiver here? It's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that you take the position that what's at issue here is subject matter jurisdiction. And I guess I have some problem with that because it strikes me that this is the kind of situation where the issue is really one of competency rather than subject matter jurisdiction. And as you're well aware, competency issue can be waived or forfeited. It depends on what term we're going to use, I guess. What's your position on all of that? Why do you think this is subject matter jurisdiction?
This being a matter of statutory interpretation, we have to start with the plain language of the statute. And the statute throughout says jurisdiction. We know that the legislature, in close proximity to this statute, uses competency in other statutes. So we assume that the legislature knows the difference between the two concepts. We also have a presumption that the legislature means what it says and says what it meant. So it chose to use the word jurisdiction in this statute, not competency. That's, I think, the plainest indicator of the fact that this statute does concern subject matter jurisdiction.
But don't we have all kinds of cases in Wisconsin that basically would stand for the proposition that the circuit court has subject matter jurisdiction, period, in every situation? So why is this jurisdiction rather than competency, even though that's the term the legislature used?
I would start by saying that I don't think we necessarily need to resolve that question today, because as a matter of statutory interpretation, we can just rest on the language of the statute and this Court's opinion in Claeser, which described this concept in terms of jurisdiction, not competency. But
do you think maybe we were a little bit loose in that case in terms of the term we were using?
I don't think you were.
Of course not.
There are multiple opinions in that decision, and all of them use the word jurisdiction across the board. The word competency doesn't appear there, and this court is well aware of that distinction if you look at all of the other decisions addressing it. So my interpretation that I offer to you is that you meant what you said in that case. Now,
what about the Constitution?
That, of course, is the other big answer to Justice Crook's question, and it's the one I don't think we need to reach, but if we do, the answer is the Constitution, Article 7, Section 8, says, except as otherwise provided by law, the courts shall have such and such jurisdiction.
Somehow the cases forgot that.
Most of them seem to have most recently, but if you look back further, there's about 100 years of precedent on this point where this court recognizes the plain meaning of those words. Except as otherwise by law means the legislature may, by statute, define the contours of the court's, of the circuit court's jurisdiction.
Could I ask you if we could go back to the preliminary examination? The judge says, I find a violation or a felony. What should have happened then?
Procedurally, Your Honor?
No.
The defense objected to Bindover, and we would say that objection should have been sustained, but it seems unlikely that the court would have done that if it had thought it was doing the right thing. The ideal of what should have happened under the statute is that should have been the end of it, and Tolliver should have been discharged, and the state could have proceeded against him in juvenile court if it had wished to do so.
Well, my limited experience as a prosecutor was that virtually every preliminary examination, the defense says we object to the Bindover. So there was no specific objection here. If there had been a specific objection, the court would have understood that saying felony was not enough. There was no request for a discharge, was there?
No, there was no request for a discharge.
Okay, let's suppose the specific objections had been made. The court agreed with that. A request for a discharge had been made. The court agreed to that. What would have happened then?
If the court had agreed to the request for discharge, then Tolliver would have been discharged and the state could have proceeded against him in juvenile court.
Okay, what do you think would have happened in juvenile court?
He may or may not have been found delinquent or guilty of one of the juvenile dispositions.
Well, don't you think there might have been a waiver hearing?
Oh, I'm sorry. Of course, yes, Your Honor. The next step would have been a waiver hearing, yes.
And it might have gone back to the same court.
It could have been after a much more deliberate and methodical analysis that waiver hearing calls for, yes.
But the court would have had jurisdiction to try this defendant.
The jurisdiction would have passed to the juvenile court for the determination of that waiver hearing, and if it had waived its jurisdiction, then it would have passed back to the adult court. But it can't be in more than one place at once. We know that.
What's the difference between jurisdiction and original adult jurisdiction?
We say that the reference in the statute to original adult jurisdiction is a reference to subject matter jurisdiction, so there would be no difference between the two. The statute itself says jurisdiction, and the only two concepts of jurisdiction that I'm aware of are subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction, and I don't think anyone is arguing that it's personal jurisdiction. So by process of elimination, and also because this statute enumerates certain offenses, the subject matter of which gives rise to the criminal complaint, we land at subject matter jurisdiction. So that really is what's at issue here.
Well, it could have been reverse waiver.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If the court had found probable cause for this felony, there could still have been reverse waiver, and then some other court would have had jurisdiction.
That's true. And, in fact, here Tolliver did move for reverse waiver, and that was denied.
And if there had been a discharge and had gone back to juvenile court and then waiver back to adult court, the court would have had jurisdiction then.
These things are all true, yes.
If you do it right, you get jurisdiction, right?
That's correct. And if you don't, you lose it.
Okay. Now, well, let me ask this. It seems to me you're parroting the Glaser case, and that wasn't decided until well over a year after the preliminary examination here. Does that make any difference?
We note that fact in our brief, Your Honor, and we give credit to the initial court by saying that it didn't have the benefit of this court's guidance from that case at the time that it made the deficient probable cause hearing at issue here. But we emphasize – I see that my red light is on.
You should continue, counsel.
We emphasize in the same place in our brief that the requirement that we are describing of a specific probable cause finding does not come from Glaser. It comes from the statute itself. Glaser interpreted and provided some guidance to the courts, and I think that this court could provide some more, and that's why we're here today. But the requirement doesn't stem from that decision. It stems from the law.
Could I ask you, what is the specific relief you're asking for here?
We're asking this court to explain the importance of this probable cause finding to the lower courts so that they get it right, and in our case, we're asking to remand to the circuit court to vacate the conviction.
And then what?
Then Tolliver is no longer a juvenile, and the only other option offered under the statute is prosecution as a juvenile. So the state could make an argument that it could try and convict Tolliver again. We would argue that the statute doesn't allow that. But even if the statute does allow that, the fact that the state would have to go to the trouble and expense of charging him again and trying him again and convicting him again would perhaps align incentives to be careful at this critical moment in exactly the way we're asking the court to be.
So he goes scot-free?
Well, he doesn't walk, Your Honor. He's already served the maximum disposition that he could have served after juvenile proceedings, and he's done it in an adult court.
And how many years was that?
We're approaching 5 years now. And I would add to that point that we routinely, in criminal matters, allow defendants to go free when we come to the conclusion that the state or the court has made an error in an area that we decide is very fundamentally important. Certain passages of the Bill of Rights come to mind. So this, too, is an important area because it's subject matter jurisdiction, and that's what allows courts to do things to people. If you don't have it, then anything that follows is void as a matter of law, and that's what we're concerned about here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions? You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Catherine Desmond Lloyd, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
The court. Tolliver began his reply brief by stating that this appeal concerns a specific statute that confers subject matter jurisdiction under specific conditions that were not met here. The state's position is that this is incorrect for a couple of reasons. One, this statute, 970.032, doesn't confer jurisdiction on the circuit court. The circuit court has subject matter jurisdiction, as this court and the Court of Appeals has said numerous times, over all actions, civil and criminal. So this statute might define some of the contours of that authority, but it's not conferring jurisdiction on the circuit court.
Are you familiar with the Glaser case?
Yes.
And if this is an unfair question, I'll look it up later. But in the Glaser case at paragraph 16, it cites to a form that Glaser submitted to the court. It's called a preliminary hearing questionnaire and waiver form. And in the form, it's quoted. It states, "I understand that by waiving the preliminary hearing, I am conceding that the state can establish probable cause, comma, and that I will be ordered to stand trial, period, end of quote." Is that what the form says, and is that a state records management required form?
When a defendant waives a preliminary hearing? I'm sorry, I don't know.
That court requires certain forms require the court to use those, presumably because we think they're right. And I'm just wondering, because in that form it doesn't mention anything about probable cause for fill in the blank.
Right.
Maybe unfair question. Never mind.
No, it's probably not. I just don't think I know the answer.
Okay, I'll look it up because that'll be, you know, available to
okay.
anyone.
Is that form in the record?
Well, he didn't waive the preliminary hearing,
okay.
so it wasn't
well, we
an
don't
issue
have to worry about it here.
In this case, right.
Well, but if you waive a right, you have to know what right you're waiving,
that's,
right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we wouldn't want to instruct someone to waive a general right when it needs to be more specific.
That's,
so we might need to look at that form depending on how this case comes
right,
out.
Right, I understand your concern now. Sorry, yes. Okay, and that, so as for the first point, again, I don't believe this statute is what confers jurisdiction. It's the Constitution.
How do you read the first clause?
I read that as setting parameters that the legislature can legislate. They make laws all the time that get, you know, that tell the courts how to conduct things. But I don't read that as having, I don't read that as saying the legislature gives jurisdiction.
No, but can it take away jurisdiction?
Well, it seems like it does, it has in some of these cases, particularly involving time limits and things like that. It seems like the legislature and the courts have approved of the idea that if a party or a court doesn't act within a certain time period, sometimes jurisdiction.
Well, it abolished various claims, like claims about alienation of affection was abolished.
Sure.
And so a court cannot handle that claim.
Right. Sure. I do think it does that actually all the time. I mean, for example, in, you know, say an animal cruelty context, it's, you know, it says, well, hunting and scientific purposes don't come within the purview of what's considered cruel, so the court couldn't hear cases like that. So, yeah, I think that that happens all the time. But, again, my issue is just that it's not the legislature that gives jurisdiction. It might shape the contours of it, but it
So it can take away jurisdiction. So to say that the circuit courts have total jurisdiction, original jurisdiction in all civil and criminal actions is not correct.
Well, no, I would say that is correct. They have them over all criminal and civil actions. If something isn't a criminal...
Except if the legislature takes it away.
Right. If it's no longer a criminal or civil action, it doesn't have jurisdiction over it. As long as the subject is permissible under the legislative scheme, then the court has jurisdiction.
So the Constitution limits the legislative power over courts.
I don't
And you
know that
read except... That you read that clause to mean that the legislature can eliminate a cause of action.
Yes. And that, therefore, the court would no longer have subject
That's
matter
right.
jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. But it can't say you have jurisdiction only over 10-year-olds or only over 15-year-olds. Or you don't have jurisdiction over 15-year-olds. Is that right? Is that the state's position?
I don't know how far the legislature could go without bumping up against Article 7.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that...
Article 7, Section 8.
Section 8. But just as the judiciary as a whole, I don't know. I mean, there's a couple branches here, and I...
But you recognize that Vicrut is the broadest statement.
I do.
Without any citation. Right?
I do recognize that that language is pretty sweeping.
And no recognition of the introductory clause to the Constitution.
Right.
Okay. So it went as far as it could go.
It went pretty far. I would agree with that. On the other hand, I think that the limitations that this court or any court in Wisconsin has found on subject matter jurisdiction or when a court loses it are exceptionally rare. And it would be a novel thing to say that this court, this circuit court, had subject matter jurisdiction over an attempted homicide and then lost it by failing to say the specific offense. When we can tell from this record, and reviewing courts look at probable cause determinations with a real limited scope and say, is there sufficient facts on this record to support the determination of probable cause? And I would say that'd be no different under 970.032. We look at whether there were sufficient facts for him to find probable cause of the qualifying offense, and there certainly was.
But he didn't find that.
He didn't say he found that. I think he certainly found that. And, again, this court looks at...
Say it, but you can say he found it.
I'm sorry?
He didn't... The court did not say that, but we can say he did anyway.
Yes, I think so. I think that when this court reviews, it's a legal finding. You're not assessing credibility. You're just reviewing plausibility. And first-degree attempted homicide for shooting someone in the back over gambling, I think, is a very plausible charge of first-degree attempted homicide. And further...
Why are we having any preliminary hearing at all, then?
I'm not sure what you mean, because the legislature...
Well, the complaint says something about what happened, and if you're going to just accept that...
Well, it's not under oath. The defendants are allowed to have someone testify under oath that this happened and allow him to cross-examine him and allow him in under 970.032 to put on evidence.
Yep.
And try to mitigate the charge.
She did not attempt to do here.
She did not.
Counselor,
what
about... It
would have been better had the state just said after the motion to reconsider, why didn't the state just say, heck, we'll just do it over. It's so simple. We'll just do it over. We'll dismiss this without prejudice, and we'll just start again, do it over. It would be cheaper for the state than to go to the Court of Appeals, come here, maybe have to go back, maybe not. I mean, why do that? Why not just, hey? I mean, this preliminary couldn't have taken more than, what, 2 hours?
The preliminary hearing? Yeah, I think it was probably quite less than that.
Yeah, I said it couldn't have been more than two hours. Could have done it again.
Yes, but I can't litigate this below.
Yeah.
And the defendant moved the circuit court to reopen it, and that's when you get the decision from Judge Flancher approving of the probable cause finding. So essentially she looked at it all again then. I don't think that they thought this would be in this posture at this point, since this question wasn't raised until the reply brief in terms of subject matter jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals.
Well, that's another issue.
Yeah.
Counselor, I want to look at the statute a little bit, and I'm wondering, you know, the statute says if the court does not make that finding, why shouldn't I interpret that phrase to mean the court says, I do not find probable cause to support the bindover on the matter charged? Why do I have to interpret that the way opposing counsel is interpreting it, requiring if there's no specific statement on the record, why not interpret it that what that means is that the court, if the court makes a contrary finding, in other words, I do not find probable cause that a qualifying offense has been committed.
I think your interpretation is the most reasonable one. It's certainly our interpretation of the statute, and I think it's consistent with the legislative scheme adopted in the mid-90s to start these juveniles in adult court for these very serious crimes, and the juvenile has at first opportunity to negate that, to mitigate it to a lower crime. If the court doesn't find that and
that's what would happen if other evidence were presented and the court was not persuaded that the count that was charged, and I understand that there are often hearings where other evidence is presented that would support a lesser charge but not a qualifying charge.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Yeah, no, that's how we interpret it as well.
I know you do, and on page 14 you say, discharge is appropriate when the court finds a lack of probable cause. That's how you just... Well, let's go back to the language. First of all, it says the court shall first determine whether there's probable cause to believe the juvenile has committed the violation of which he or she is accused. And then it says, if the court does not make that finding, so now we have to go back and substitute for the word that finding, mean if the court does not determine whether there is probable cause to believe that the juvenile has committed the violation of which he or she is accused, comma, the court shall order the juvenile discharged. But that finding has to refer back to the trial court's finding that there's probable cause for that complaint. It is not that he finds a lack of probable cause. If the court finds a lack of probable cause, the court shall order, is that what you, if the juvenile be discharged? But that's not a finding that's referred to anywhere in sub one. You know what I'm trying to?
Yeah, ask you? And I understand that position, and I think it's a reasonable reading of it. I just
Thank
think
you.
That given the legislative scheme and what this statute is meant for, that a more appropriate reading is that a court would find the state hadn't proven probable cause.
Well, you'd have to read it. If the court finds a lack of probable cause, the court shall order the juvenile be discharged.
I would read it as if the court does not find that the state has proven probable cause.
Yeah, that's putting in a lot of words.
I understand. I just think I think it makes more sense to me that what the legislature is getting at here is that the juvenile is discharged in the absence of probable cause, not in the absence of finding.
Do you think the court can tie the prosecutor to only this charge after the preliminary hearing has occurred? And what if, for example, they go to trial and they decide to submit a reckless instruction or a second-degree intentional, charge them with second degree instead of first degree? Those are all qualifying offenses. Do you think it'd be appropriate for the circuit court to tie the prosecutor's hands and say, okay, I have to make a finding as to one charge only, and that means the prosecutor can only come in later with one charge? I mean, that's never been what circuit court judges do at a probable cause prelim hearing.
Wow, I don't know the answer to that. That's a, I hadn't thought of that. It seems to me that once you're in a trial in an adult court, all the things that are available to you as in any other litigation. I mean, you're in adult court then, so I don't...
When I made probable cause findings, I make a probable cause finding that a felony has occurred. Now, that's typically an adult jurisdiction, but here in the context of a juvenile charge where in the charging document itself it has his date of birth, 12/24/92, in the charging document. So those are things on their face that show this person's age. I'm curious as to, and I'm not going to ask the question again, but I'm going to ask the petitioner to respond to that. How would a court, I guess you'd just ask, or they'd be asking just to say that a qualifying offense, that there was a charge of a qualifying offense?
At a subsequent trial you're talking about?
I'm talking in this case. I think what the petitioner is asking for is, I find probable cause that a qualifying offense has occurred.
Right.
Rather than what I initially heard them arguing, which is I find probable cause that the charged offense has occurred. Because it could be a variety of things.
Right.
And we all know that as you go through trial, you can have lesser included. You can have different things that come out. And in this particular even subsection, there's first-degree intentional, first-degree reckless, second-degree intentional. So any of those things could be possible even under this subsection of the juvenile code.
Right. Yes.
Does that argument work in your favor or against you?
That the court did, I'm sorry if I'm...
I'm not arguing one way or the other. I'm asking you, does that provision work for you or against you in the general
finding? The idea that the judge needed only to find probable cause of a qualifying offense as opposed to the offense charged?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, first of all, I think that's consistent with this. I think that's what the statute says on its face. So, and I don't know that it matters so much in this case because I think there was an abundance of evidence of first-degree attempted homicide, but I suppose it would probably only help the state's position.
Well, the offense to which he ultimately pled is a qualifying offense, too, isn't it?
Well, I don't believe it is. Is it?
Okay. You don't think so. All right.
I don't think
it is. Oh, first degree reckless is...
Okay, sorry, I thought it was second degree reckless.
No, it was first degree. I thought it was.
942.
At least when I looked it up.
Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
You know, I found it interesting when I read the transcript. Nothing was ever said about a juvenile. And then 970.032 subsection 2 says, if the court finds probable cause to believe the juvenile has committed the violation of which he is accused, and you say that is what happened by Judge Constantine, then it says the court shall determine whether to retain jurisdiction or transfer it. Judge never did that here.
There was a reverse waiver hearing several months later.
Oh, but not at that time.
Not at that point, but I don't think that that's usually when that happens. I think that frequently happens at a later date.
Okay.
No, that was satisfied, which was an answer to...
Only on a motion.
Well, it says it shall, so I think it's supposed to, but I think in practice it usually comes about by a motion.
It doesn't say here in the statute that there has to be a motion. It sounded to me, and I didn't check it out, that it should be done immediately. If you find probable cause, then you go to determine whether you retain jurisdiction or transfer it. And then it says the court shall retain jurisdiction unless the juvenile proves. And the juvenile didn't do any of this proof, but he did
attempt to do that later.
Later. That's right.
But I think I don't know. This is my first juvenile case, so I'm no expert in this area. But I think it's quite routine to have the reverse waiver hearing at a somewhat later date. I don't think that that's unusual in this case. I'm sorry.
Counsel's a follow-up to the question of the Chief Justice. The language he was reading, the court shall retain jurisdiction unless the juvenile proves by a preponderance of the evidence, speaks to me of a more flexible approach to jurisdiction rather than the court always has subject matter jurisdiction in all criminal and civil cases. I mean, what are they talking about? They're not talking about the court always that kind of subject matter jurisdiction when it says the court shall retain jurisdiction. If the court has jurisdiction in all civil and criminal cases, then that phrase is meaningless. What do you think about that?
Well, our position on this is that this, as the Court of Appeals, I think, did a much better job than I ever could articulating the difference between jurisdiction and competency in the State versus Schrader case. And I think that what it says, that was in the context of Chapter 48, but the same idea would apply, is that jurisdiction in these statutes here doesn't mean subject matter jurisdiction. It means competency.
Well, how can it say that when in other parts of the statute in Chapter 48, it uses the words competency? So the legislature knows the difference, and sometimes it uses competence, sometimes it uses jurisdiction. And it seems to me that the state and the court system just substitutes what it wants instead of following what the legislature said.
Well, I would say that the legislature is also aware of this court's decisions and the Court of Appeals decisions, which say that jurisdiction in this context means competency. And instead of amending the statutes to say, put in subject matter jurisdiction, they just keep saying jurisdiction. So I think if the legislature thought that the courts were getting it wrong on competency, they could have easily amended the statutes to write in, no, we may in subject matter jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction means something different when it comes to juvenile court, though. I mean, it's a unique subset of court. It reminds me of when there used to be a subset of akin to a subset of a probate court, you know, or a different kind of specialized courts in the past. And juvenile jurisdiction is a phrase that has jurisdiction in the juvenile sense, juvenile court sense, has, I think, some unique meaning. And you're suggesting that it does or it doesn't.
I'm suggesting that it doesn't anymore. Since the change in the mid-90s, we no longer have juvenile court, or since before that, but particularly since then, we no longer have juvenile courts and adult courts, and this language, I think, is really misleading, and we just have a circuit court, and it either adjudicates under the criminal code or adjudicates under the juvenile justice code. But this notion of jurisdiction, I think, isn't subject matter jurisdiction.
What do you do as a judge when you look at this language that the legislature wrote, and it seems a little, I don't know if anything is clear in life, but, you know, it says jurisdiction, but they really don't mean jurisdiction. It says the court shall first determine whether there is probable cause to believe that the juvenile has committed the violation of which he or she is accused, but they really don't mean that. If the court does not make that finding, the court, you know, I mean, how many times can we discount what they're saying when the words aren't necessarily ambiguous just because it doesn't seem like it's a good idea for them to say it?
I don't, that's not my position. That's not what I'm attempting to argue here, and I'm sorry if I've been misleading. Our position is that in this case, a 16-year-old accused of attempted first-degree homicide goes before the circuit court. And that court makes a probable cause determination whether a qualifying offense has been shown. If the court finds that probable cause hasn't been shown, then it discharges the juvenile.
A probable cause of the qualifying offense.
Right. Right. And I think that that's consistent with the statute. I think that's what the statute says. And I also think that that's what happened here. I think that if we had a case in which that's not what happened, it would go to the court's competency to hear the case. And then the court would have no longer had the authority to adjudicate the subject. But as this court said in Trempolo, competency can be waived. So, but again, I think the probable cause finding was made
here. Let me interrupt you for a minute. Did you find any legislative history that was helpful in regard to interpreting the statute at issue here?
I didn't do any independent legislative research. I relied a lot on Klesser's history of the Juvenile Justice Code and the commission's report.
Did you look at the Juvenile Justice Study Committee report and recommendations?
Yes.
Are you aware of the fact that the recommendations made by the committee did not include this procedure, that this procedure was basically added later by the legislature?
I was not aware of that.
Well, you can take my word for it.
I believe you. I see your name on it.
But my concern is, is there no legislative history? You found nothing that directly went to these provisions being added?
I did not mean to say I found nothing. I did not do legislative research on the history of this.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a couple quick points to address Mr. Tolliver's argument. One, he said here today that the only thing that stands between a juvenile and adult court adjudication is this probable cause finding, and I would say that's not true. The juvenile also has the opportunity at the reverse waiver hearing to show why he isn't, why adult court isn't appropriate for him. So there's two opportunities. The other thing I wanted to say was, as far as what we know about the preliminary hearing and whether or not the court was aware that Mr. Tolliver was a juvenile, I agree the record is pretty sparse, but I think it is worth remembering that he was also charged with being a person under the age of 18 with a dangerous weapon.
Does the record indicate whether his date of birth was present on the complaint?
I think that that is yes, but I don't think the record shows that the circuit court was looking at the complaint. And we can, again, infer that that's what happened. But
if the circuit court, I've never been a trial judge, but if the circuit court doesn't look at the complaint, what is the basis for the evidence that we're presenting?
Again, I agree. I assume that the circuit court was looking at the complaint, which had the date on it. But
counsel, is it a matter of black-letter law that a reviewing court is to look for reasons within the record to support the factual findings of the trial court?
Of course. And the reviewing court is very limited in its ability to review a bindover.
And do you agree with Justice Rogensack's observation made in the context of a question posed to your opposing counsel that it is our job to review the totality of the record in order to determine whether the court's finding had a basis in fact?
Certainly, yes.
All right.
As a follow-up to Justice Gableman, I, too, am searching for certain what I would call canons of construction. That might not be the exact phrase to use with regard to this inquiry, but standards or maxims of review that help us to know which way to go. And when you search the record, for instance, to support the trial court's finding, I guess in part, for me, that begs the question of what was the trial court's finding here? You know, and there's the arguments advanced that he did make the requisite finding, and there's an argument advanced that he didn't make the requisite finding. That's the two of you. And another maxim is you can, you know, look at the whole record. What other maxims would be supportive of your position? Interpretive tools that we can use to perhaps make a gray area a little clearer.
I would cite State v. Kies, 309 with second 516, which just says that this court employs an extremely limited review of a bindover, and as long as there's sufficient evidence to support the probable cause finding, which in this case I would say, as long as there's sufficient evidence to support the court's finding that, to support a finding that Mr. Tolliver, the probable cause that he committed attempted first-degree homicide.
Okay,
then the inquiry
what does that case say? I'm not familiar with that. The finding or a finding?
To support a probable cause finding.
Yeah, see, is that a juvenile case?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
That kind of begs the question, what's the finding here? Before we can find evidence to support it, we have to know what it is.
First of all, I think it was of a qualifying offense. Just because he didn't say that, I don't think, if he'd said something else, like I find probable cause of battery for something, you know, there'd be a different position. But I think you just look at what was presented to him, and as long as that supports a finding of probable cause, then the statute has been satisfied.
A finding of probable cause to believe that the juvenile has committed the violation of which he or she is accused.
Right, of the qualifying offense.
There was an information filed in this case?
Assume so, but I don't know.
On May 7th.
Thank you.
Well, I'm reading from the transcript. In appendix page 24, where the court says, I would note there is probable cause to believe a felony has been committed. The testimony we have is from the victim. You have identification. You have a shooting. Bindover is ordered. And then the court says, I do have an information. Two counts. Do you acknowledge receipt? I do. Waive the reading thereof. Enter a plea of not guilty to all allegations thereof. What did the information, right, being held in the judge's hand, say that this was attempted first degree intentional homicide?
I assume yes. I don't know what else it would have said. As well as the possession of a dangerous weapon under the age of 18. Unless there any other questions?
Just for clarification, I don't have the information. Others do. You're assuming, or do you know? I mean,
I don't know. I'm sorry, I haven't looked at the information in quite some time. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Goldschmidt.
I'd like to begin with a little bit of cleanup. One of the questions asked during the previous presentation was whether the offenses that were pleaded to were qualifying offenses, and the answer to that question is no. One was a Class D felony, one was a Class E felony, and neither of those are qualifying offenses for purposes of the statute.
I'm sorry.
Plead guilty.
Say that again.
First degree reckless?
Oh, the ones that were pleaded to on the plea deal,
yes.
They weren't qualifying. I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
Correct.
Yeah.
He didn't?
I agree with that.
Okay.
Right. So first-degree reckless injury,
okay,
and robbery with threat of force. So those are not qualifying offenses under the statute. Second, I wanted to address Justice Ziegler's question, since I'll probably hear it anyway, about the question of will imposing the burden that we're asking for tie the circuit court's hands? And I would start again with the language of the statute, which says, the offense of which he or she is accused. So already the law, not me, not this court, requires the circuit court to make a probable cause finding that is specific to that charged offense. That means that if the court makes that finding, we can go on to have a trial on that offense, but I don't think that the state could then introduce other charges if they wouldn't be, well, I should be more clear. I don't think the state could proceed on a different theory of the case. So its hands are tied by the statute and by the fact that it has to get to trial, adult trial, through that narrow door.
But once they get there, I mean, you can amend an information after it's been, after the preliminary in an adult and it's been issued, you can add other charges and amend the information. So I would assume you could amend this information, too. Once he's in adult court, he just is proceeding with adult criminal proceedings applied to him, isn't he?
And I'm not saying that you couldn't add charges. I wasn't clear before, and I apologize.
Okay.
What I mean
yeah.
to say is the state couldn't then amend it down below the level of what would have gotten them into adult court in the first place.
Oh, I see what you're
that's
saying.
That's all I mean to say.
But that's what happened here. Yeah.
Well, what happened here was he pled. So I think that's
because
a different
because they amended down. I mean, that just doesn't come out of the blue. He has to plead to something. The charge has to be amended. Be careful what you wish for is what I'm saying to you. What you're sort of doing is locking a juvenile in. Once they're waived, they can never plead to anything less than the charged offense. And I'm not sure that's really where you intend to go.
It's not where I intend to go. And I do need to be careful here. I think the only point that I was trying to make in responding to that question was that the state, having gotten into adult court, would need to continue to show facts to leave it there. Not that the state couldn't obviously accept a plea deal for lesser charges. A couple of other points briefly. We heard a lot more speculation about what happened and didn't happen at this preliminary hearing. I would just urge the court to go back and read the transcript of that hearing cover to cover. It's not long, 10 pages. And see if you can distinguish between that hearing and a routine adult bindover. The other thing that I note about that preliminary hearing is that it's very urgent and rushed. The attorney, the prosecutor comes into the court, says, we've got to have a preliminary hearing. We've got the victim in the hospital. He's on the line. We have to do this now, judge. And then they take a little testimony. They talk to the victim. They talk to a police officer who talked to the victim. And the court makes a very cursory probable cause finding, almost as an afterthought to ordering bindover. So I think it's fair to say that the court really didn't take the care that it was required to take in these particular circumstances, where we have a juvenile about to be tried as an adult, which is a momentous step based on all of the differences between juveniles and adults and the two respective systems that I discussed before. That also goes to Justice Prosser's point about the fact that the judge had the information before him. He says he did, but did he go through the analysis and understand that actually what we're talking about here is that special decision to try a juvenile as an adult as opposed to the routine decision to bind over an adult defendant? I don't think that even if the judge did see that information before him, that we have enough on the basis of this transcript to know that the judge did the analysis he was supposed to do here. It's not a routine adult bind over. I see that my red light is on, so I'll stop unless there are any further questions.
I don't see any further questions, counsel. So thank you, and thank you, Ms. Lloyd, for your arguments today in this juvenile matter. Ms. Goldschmidt, are you pro bono counsel?
I am, Your Honor.
Well, I want to thank you on behalf of the court for taking on this responsibility and providing the court with extensive material in both the appendices and brief and in your oral argument. Which doesn't mean that just because you're paid, Ms. Lloyd, we don't thank you for your excellent representation, too. But I want to thank you, Mr. Goldschmidt, and your companions on the brief and the law firm. And that concludes our hearing in 2012 AP 293 CR, State versus Tolliver. The court will meet in conference room and closed conference at 3:15. And we meet again for oral argument next week.